So a couple of weeks ago on a Wednesday night, a high school kids and I were working on this question. Do y'all remember this? Y'all still have to hang with me, though, even though you've been here before. We were working on this question. Why do people believe the things that they believe? And we were driving to the more important question, why do I believe the things that I believe? And so we spent a half hour or so kicking that question around, and they gave me some answers, and we made a list on the board, and I tell you, it was a really meaningful and important discussion. And I thought about it for several days after that, and it occurred to me, that's not just something important for teenagers to think about, that we all need to think about why believe the things that we believe. And so I decided this morning to loop all of you in to that conversation and ask you to think with me about that question this morning. I should say at first, I've got some assumptions at work when I pose that question this morning. For example, I'm assuming that there are different answers, or this wouldn't be a very long sermon, right? And I think that's so when you stop and think about it, that people have different reasons for believing the things that they believe. I think that we all know that so, but I don't think often enough we go there and we get underneath the things that we believe and ponder our spiritual foundation on which our beliefs rest, and to ask, is that foundation solid? Do I have good reasons for believing what I believe? Which brings me to a second assumption that I'm working with today, and that is that not all reasons are reasons. What would the point of talking about this be then, right? That some reasons are better than others. In fact, some reasons are no good at all. Foundations can be flimsy. And if they are, they will not hold up to scrutiny and testing. And that is particularly in a culture like ours, where the most fundamental things we believe as disciples is under assault. We're being challenged to answer. Why do you believe that? Why do you believe there's a God? We need good reasons for believing the things that we believe. Which brings me to a second thing I want to put on the table right here at the beginning before we get into the lesson. And that is, I think if we'll be willing to go here and to ask this question, to ponder this, that's going to help us in some really important ways. For example, I think thinking about this will help us when we are trying to talk to other people about Jesus, which often involves trying to correct things that people believe that are not true. Sometimes that's hard, right? Sometimes it's hard to shake loose wrong thinking, especially when I don't first understand people are holding on to it so tightly. Does that make sense? For those of you who are in the tactics class, now we're going back to those burden of proof questions, those questions that get down under the foundation. I think more often when we're talking to people about what they believe, we need to start by asking, that's really interesting. Could you tell me why you believe that? Or what is it that led you to that conclusion? What's underneath there? Frankly, folks, how people answer that question may change everything about the way we talk to them. So I think pondering this will help us talk to people about Jesus, but more importantly, I think it will help us with the things that we believe. Frankly, brothers and sisters, we need to make sure that there is something solid under our belief, that our spiritual foundation is strong. Our faith must rest on that kind of foundation. Our children must grow up with that kind of foundation, in this age in which we are living. And so I invite you this morning, as we think about this question, to spend this time looking inward. Let's focus on me and you and the things that we believe. And even though it's going to help us talk to others, we need to begin with self And so lurking in the background all the way through this, I hope you will join me in wrestling with the question, why do I believe what I believe? And is there a good foundation under there? So with that in front of us, I want to work through the list. Familiar, but y'all still have to hang with me, right? So the high school kids helped me build on the board this list. I'm going to give you four of the answers that we gave, and then a fifth one that I'm going to contend is the right one, and you can decide when we get done if that is correct. The list was actually longer, but frankly, I don't want this to be like an Astros playoff game and just go on and on and on, okay? I'm really glad you are here today. I'm worried about some of you last night. I nearly posted on Facebook, hey, you Astro fans, y'all still got to go to church tomorrow because it was a long day yesterday, right? So I've kept the list, short to these five things. Number one, when you ask, why do people believe what they believe? The first answer they gave was, well, people believe what they believe because it's what my mom and dad taught me. It's what I was raised believing. Or another way to say that, it's just what I've always believed. It's what I grew up with. Some people believe what they believe because it's what they were always taught. That does kind of make sense, doesn't it? In fact, I would contend that at one level, it's biblical. Would you go back to the book of Deuteronomy, for example? I thought about Deuteronomy chapter 6 as I was pondering this. Deuteronomy chapter 6. I would remind you that parents are actually told to teach their children what to believe, right? That's what Moses is saying to Israel as he's about to die and they're about to go into the promised land. He's worried about the future generations being faithful to the Lord. So he writes this to them, Deuteronomy 6. We'll just grab verse 6, where he says, "These words which I'm commanding you today shall be on your heart." And then he adds in verse 7, "You shall teach them diligently to your sons and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them on your hand, and they shall be as frontals for your forehead. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates." What is he saying? He said, you need to teach these things that you believe to your children. You need to keep it in front of them all of the time. That's what Scripture teaches us to do. In fact, there's more than that. Because when we get to the book of wisdom, the book of Proverbs, Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 8, the wise man says to young people, "Hear your father's instruction, do not forsake your mother's teaching." You see it? God says parents should teach their children, and he says to children, you should listen to your parents. And so it makes sense that we would begin our journey believing the things that our parents taught us. In fact, sometimes we believe those really firmly. I had a teacher come up to me after a Bible class one Sunday. This was years ago when my boys were little. And she said, we had a little problem in class today. I don't know how you taught the lesson to your son, but evidently we were not on the same page. And when I said what I said about that question, your son rose up and said, "That's not right. My dad said," you know, he's a preacher in this church. So we grow up believing that what our parents say. But there have to be some limits on that, right? You probably are already sensing that. So if you have a kid in a high school class, if they came home to you Wednesday night and said to you, "I can't just believe everything you tell me." That's true. I did say that to them. And kids need to understand that they just can't believe everything mom and dad say because, you know the answer, right? Sometimes mom and dad are wrong. Think about the children today who are growing up with bigoted parents and being taught to hate people of other races. Do you want a kid growing up believing that's true? And even if he's taught growing up, when he becomes an adult, what do we want him to do? We want him to repudiate that and reject that and believe something different. Why? Because his parents were wrong about that. That's actually a biblical idea. It's interesting to me that the same God who told parents to teach their children and children to listen, the same God who said that is also the God who told the children of the faithless wilderness generation. That's the Israelites who left Egypt and went to Sinai, and they were supposed to go up and take the land, but they were faithless, and they wouldn't do it, and they wandered for 40 years. God told their children, according to the prophet Ezekiel, in Ezekiel 20, verse 18, God told their children, don't listen to your parents. And don't do what they did, because they were wrong. In fact, just two chapters earlier in Ezekiel 18, Ezekiel will give us three hypothetical generations, a father, a son, and a grandson. And what he says about that middle generation is that middle generation, that guy looks at his father's sin and does not do likewise. He didn't do what his dad did, and he's commended for that. Hezekiah was exactly that kind of man. He chose to serve the Lord rather than follow the path of his wicked father. You can't always listen to mom and dad, because they might be wrong. So what about us? And what about the things that we're doing here today? And what about the beliefs that move us to do the things that we're doing here today? Can I ask you to think about why you believe those things? Will you be candid with yourself this morning? Am I just sitting in this pew today because for Sundays, ever since I could remember, I have sat in pews on Sunday? Is that why you're here? Or are you here because the things you believe that bring you here are just things that have been handed down by tradition in your family year after year after year? This is what your family does. Or are you here today because if you weren't, you'd be getting a text from mom, I mean like right now in the middle of church. She'd be saying, where are you? Right? And I'm just keeping mom off my back. That's not a good enough reason. And that's not a foundation that will endure. Now, I want you to know, if you got a kid in my class, maybe you're a little nervous about them being in my class now. I did tell kids, you shouldn't just assume your mom and dad are wrong. Some kids make that mistake. Well, I just can't believe everything they tell me, so I'm going to assume they're wrong. That's a bad choice, too. But the flip side of that is, we just can't assume mom and dad are right. We have to have better reasons for believing. So do you see that? Are we together about that? That's not a good enough reason. So we kept working on that list on the board. And here's the second thing that we came up with. Some people believe what they believe because it's what their friends believe, or it's what the crowd thinks, or because it is the consensus of culture. I believe it because it is what others believe. This one I think we might be a little more hesitant to own, right? Because none of us want to imagine that we're not just those people who blindly follow the crowd and do what everyone else does. We fancy ourselves independent thinkers who have a mind of our own, right? But I got to tell you, brothers and sisters, whether we're going to acknowledge it or not, the pressure to conform and to believe things and do things that the crowd around us will agree with and champion and will give us approval with the people who matter to us, that pressure is great. And it isn't just a problem for kids. We need to have an adult Bible class talking about the problem of peer pressure, because we're all subject to it. Remember those Israelites who came to the judge Samuel and said, remember what they said? Remember what they wanted? We want a king. Not a king because we think he will lead us to honor God, or because somewhere back there God said stuff about kings and we want to know if it's time. They said, we want a king because we want to be like the nations. They felt the pressure too. We're kind of backwards. We don't have a king. We need to be like everybody else. And that spirit that was present in that generation of Israelites, brothers and sisters, it can be in us too. And if we're not careful, we can become subject to it and wind up following the multitude to do evil. Of course, the problem with following the crowd is exactly the same as just blindly following mom and dad. The crowd is often wrong. The majority is often wrong. I mean, how many examples could we give of that? I had to put some boundaries down for myself, because you could start here and we could go on. I mean, this would be an 18-inning church service this morning. We could go on and on about all the examples of when the majority have been wrong. How about Noah's day? We just went through that in the Genesis class. Would you have wanted to number among the crowd, the majority, and Noah's day? They all died in the flood. It was just this little tiny remnant of people stuck in the middle of that evil culture who still loved God and served Him. And then I got to thinking how many times that was true in Israel's history. You ever pondered that? How many times that the crowd, most of the nation, majority, just got pulled off into the idolatry around them to be like the nations, to believe what other people believed. And it was only this little remnant of faithful ones who hung in there and still served Jehovah. It's often been that way. It's true biblically. But you don't have to go all the way back to Bible times. It's been true in our history. How many things, folks, have a majority of Americans believed that were just wrong? How about we just go back 150 years ago? You realize there were large segments of our population that embraced the vile practice of slavery, thought that was okay? What's the point? The crowd is often wrong. And so embracing something and believing something because it is unpopular in culture today, that's not a good enough reason. It's not a reason to believe. And so we kept working on our list in the class. They came up with a third answer. And this kind of changes directions dramatically. Why do people believe what they believe? Well, sometimes because it is what I want to be true. It is what I want to believe. And so that made me think of an Old Testament story. When you go in your Bible to 1 Kings chapter 22. Because I think this story illustrates not only someone believing what they wanted to believe, but also why that is really a dangerous thing to do. So 1 Kings 22, just a little bit of background. The wicked King Ahab has tried to persuade his neighbor to the south, Jehoshaphat, to join him in a war to go back and take Ramoth Gilead. And I don't know why Jeff Jehoshaphat is agreeable to this. I don't even know why he's talking to Ahab, but nonetheless he is. And so Jehoshaphat is inclined to do that. But in verse 5, he says, "Please inquire first for the word of the Lord. Let's find out from the prophets if God thinks this is a good idea," which is always a good starting place, right? And so Ahab says that's not a problem. And he brings in a whole group of prophets and they ask, "Should we go?" And the prophets say, "Oh yeah, yeah, you go. You are going to have a great victory." And Jehoshaphat is not satisfied with that. He's evidently a pretty shrewd guy. And he realizes, well, okay, these are Ahab's yes men. They're going to tell him whatever he wants to hear. And Jehoshaphat wants to know, you ready? He wants to know the truth about whether or not God wants them to do this. And so he says, look down at verse 7. "Is there not yet a prophet of the Lord here that we may inquire of him?" You got somebody that really will tell us the will of God? And I love Ahab's response. Look down at verse 8. He says, "There is yet one man by whom we may inquire of the Lord, but I hate him." Why? because he does not prophesy good concerning me, but evil. This prophet, Micaiah, evidently has had some interactions with Ahab before. And Ahab says, he never tells me anything good because he's a wicked king. But that's who Jehoshaphat wants to hear from. And so they bring him in. And eventually Micaiah tells Ahab the truth. Look at verse 17. The prophet says, I saw all Israel scattered on the mountains, like sheep which have no shepherd. And the Lord said, these have no master. Let each of them return to his house in peace. That is a very gentle, poetic way of saying, if you go up to this battle, you are going to die. Israel will be left without a master because their master will be killed in the battle. That is not what Ahab wanted to hear. That is not what he wanted to believe. An interesting thing, if you go on through the chapter, he chooses not to believe what is true. And we know now how that works out with him, for him. Look down at verse 34. They go up to battle for Ramoth-Gilead. And during the battle, here's what happens, according to verse 34. Now, a certain man drew his bow at random. He wasn't aiming. He's firing aimlessly. And struck the king of Israel in the joint of his armor. So he said to the driver of his chariot, turn around and take me out of the fight, for I am severely wounded. The battle raged that day. The king was propped up in his chariot in front of the Arameans, and died that evening. And the blood from the wound ran into the bottom of the chariot. So here's what I want you to see in this story. Ahab chose to believe what he wanted to be true. And even though he was warned, he did not listen. And then came reality crashing down on him. And literally, he dies. I tell you, brothers and sisters, I see the spirit of Ahab present in culture today. In fact, there can be some remnants of that even in me and you, that we are determined to believe what we want to be true. I see it all over culture today. For example, we have a lot of people in culture who are determined to believe that divorce is no big deal. That if you're in an unhappy marriage, the better choice is just to make your exit and go away and everything's going to be all right. You will do well. The kids will do well. It'll even be better for it's no big deal. Culture wants us to believe, and many people do believe, that homosexuality is just an alternate lifestyle choice. It's not different than any other way people may choose to live their life. And so that is the mantra of culture. People have accepted and embraced those two ideas. And I got to tell you, brothers and sisters, they're just wrong. I mean, obviously, you understand, biblically wrong, but statistically wrong. People hold those beliefs in spite of the mountain of evidence to the contrary. And sadly, just like Ahab, when they choose to pursue that path, they get slapped down by reality and suffer. It is the problem with believing something simply because I want it to be true. You know, the sad thing is, folks, even if you don't believe it's the wrong choice, and even if you don't believe you'll suffer, if it isn't true and it is wrong, the suffering will come. We need a better reason to believe. I can't believe something just because I want it to be true. Can I be honest with you about that? That applies to me and you too. Look, I want to believe that there is a God, and I want to believe that the Bible is true when it promises there is life beyond the grave. I want that to be so. especially now that I know that I'm quickly closing in on the back end of my life. I want that to be true, but it's not a good enough reason to believe it is. We need better reasons. And so, I threw in this fourth one because I wanted to throw the class a bit of a curve. Maybe it'll be a little bit of a curve for you too. Some people believe what they believe because it's what they're taught in their holy book. And maybe you're listening to that and you're thinking, well, that's not number five, David. That one's right, right? I think our impulse is to believe that this is a good reason to believe. We say to ourselves that it's in the Bible, and the Bible comes from God, and God is true. What he says is true. So if it's in the book, it's true. But you notice, I didn't say the Bible. I said my holy book. Do you see where that's going? We're not the only ones with a holy book. In fact, you do realize that there's a group that meets over there. I never can figure out what direction I'm in this building. Over there, that has a different holy book. And our neighbors, right next door, I'm glad the door is open so I can peek out, right here, have a set of holy books that say things different than our book says. And so the question that's hanging out there is, whose holy book? Which book's teaching is true? I raised that point this morning because it's saying something important about the Bible, brothers and sisters, and that is we cannot begin with the assumption that the Bible is from God and it must be true. We can't begin there. Now, the Bible certainly claims that for itself. Jeff was reading this morning from the book of Isaiah. Isaiah begins his book in Isaiah 1 and verse 2 and says, "Listen, O heavens, and hear, O earth, for the Lord speaks." And so the prophet says, listen, I'm just not going to rant about culture and how unhappy I am with our culture. I'm about to tell you what God said. But how do we know that's true? What evidence is there of that? You see, before I can say, I believe it's in the Bible, there is another question that has to be answered. Which brings me to number five. And I would contend the only good reason to believe something. Some people believe what they believe because it is true. Now, let me be clear what I mean by that. I'm not saying believe it because I want to believe it's true. We've already dealt with that, right? No, I mean legitimately. I believe it because it is true. What does that mean? Because it agrees with reality. It agrees with what is real. Because it is logically sound. Because there is evidence to back it up. That's why I believe the Bible, folks. I don't just blindly accept, hey, it says it's from God, so it must be true. I'll tell you why I believe it's the Bible. Because there is compelling evidence. They said God had to be behind this message. I often point people to Ezekiel 26 when Ezekiel started talking about the future of the ancient city of Tyre. And guys, long in advance, he starts talking way out there about what's going to happen to the city. I mean, little bitty details about what's coming from them. Things that there's no way he could have possibly known. This information had to come from God. And there's loads of evidence like that to demonstrate. Look, if you're going to tell me the book is a purely human product, I need you to explain Ezekiel 26, because I don't know how he knew all that stuff about what was coming for Tyre. There's a whole bunch of other stuff just like that that convinces me this book had to be from God. In fact, folks, I'll tell you, I think when you honestly examine the evidence, it is irrational to believe otherwise. It is interesting that Jesus will hold himself to the same standard. Did you realize that? Let's go to the New Testament now, to John chapter 10. John chapter 10. You know, Jesus made startling claims about himself. I mean, he was always kind of freaking out the people who followed him with things he would say about himself. He does that here in John 10. In John 10 and verse 30, he says, I and the Father are one. And listen, the crowds knew what he was saying about that. They knew that that was a claim to be equal with God. That's why they're ready to execute him on the spot. Those who are in the Sermon on the Mount class may remember that we noticed Jesus there claiming that he was the one who could tell everybody what the law of God was really saying. He taught with authority, which was disturbing to his audiences. In fact, he allowed men to call him God and to worship him as God. Here's the thing. He did not expect that people would just believe that and embrace it because he said it. Look at verse 37, John 10. Here's what Jesus says to his enemies. I love the way that he puts it all on the table here. In verse 37, he says, if I do not do the works of my Father, and I think that's a reference to his miracles. If I do not do the works of my Father, do not believe me. Do you see it? He says, if his claims have no evidence, they should not be believed. You see, his claims are subject to that same ultimate test. Are they true? Do they agree with reality? Is there evidence to back them up? In fact, he goes on in verse 37 and really tries to focus his critics on the evidence. He said, but if I do them, that is if I do the works of the Father, if I'm working miracles here, though you do not believe me, believe the works so that you may know and understand that the Father is in me and I am in the Father. What is he saying there? He's saying, look, you guys need to get over the issues you have with me. Because his enemies did have issues with him that blinded them the truth. And what he does is he says, you need to get over your issues with me and look at the evidence. Look at the works. See what Nicodemus saw. Remember what he said to Jesus when he came to him at night in John 3:2? He said, we know that you come from God as a teacher, for no one can do the signs you're doing unless God is with him. And so here's a man who's standing against all the pressure of his culture and his crowd, and he's saying, look, I know the truth about you because I've seen the evidence, and you just can't get past it. I think about Thomas. We look down on Thomas as the doubter. I'm not sure we're being fair with him. I think Thomas is who demanded evidence. He heard other people say, hey, he's risen. And what Thomas say? Not till I see the evidence. And so you notice that when Jesus meets with Thomas, he doesn't admonish him and say, what a bum you are for not believing. I told you I was going to rise. He goes to Thomas and does what? Do you remember? Look at my hands. Look at my side. What's he telling him to do? You examine the evidence and believe. Thomas responds, John 20, verse 27, is my Lord and my God. He only believed when he saw the evidence. And so I'm thinking, folks, that if Jesus' own claims were subject to the test, should that not also be true of the things that you and I believe? It isn't about what mom and dad taught me all along. They may be wrong about all of this. And it isn't about what culture says or what's popularly accepted. That may well be wrong because it often has been. And it certainly can't be about what I want to be true. Because if I start hanging on what I just want to be so, reality's going to start slapping me in the face. And that's not going to be pleasant. Is it real? Is it logically sound? Is there evidence for it? Those are good reasons to believe. So can I go back where we started and say, first, I think that will help us when we talk to other people. I think when someone is sharing with us, something that they believe rather than starting by challenging or criticizing. How about beginning with curiosity? That's interesting. Can you tell me why you believe that? Can you tell me what led you to that conclusion? What's underneath that? Because that answer may change everything about the conversation that follows. But more importantly, I think exploring this question is going to help us with our own spiritual foundation. I think some people are afraid to do that. I think we just kind of want to stay up here on top and hang on to our beliefs because we're afraid if I start getting underneath and looking at the evidence, looking at the foundation, I may find something I don't like. And so let me just say with crystal clarity this morning, brothers and sisters, that is not who we are. We are not guardians of the traditions. We are people on a quest to know what is true. We are living in a time where the most basic things that we believe to be true are under assault. I will not survive on a borrowed faith or a faith that's flimsy and weak. I need to know what I believe. I need to have good reasons for believing. The only good reason is because it's true. It's an odd thing to me that there are actually people who don't seem interested in knowing what is true. Have you encountered folks like that? People, in fact, will argue that there is no such thing as absolute truth, which, by the way, is not true because it's logically unsound. If you ever have someone say to you, there is no absolute truth, the response is, are you absolutely sure that's true? Problem solved, right? But people seem determined to allow everyone just to have their own version of truth. That's popular in culture today, too. The problem with that path is that there is pain at the end of it. Will you remember Ahab, who discovered reality's nasty tendency to slap us in the face? I have watched with grief as our culture has embraced this transgender movement and now is even inflicting it on children. I have watched that with grief because, brothers and sisters, there is suffering at the end of that road because it isn't true. The evidence is there. It's in Scripture, which is most important, but we can see it in the statistical data. No matter what we decide to believe about it, the suffering comes whether we agree it is coming or not. We can't have our own version of truth. We have to know what is true. That is never more important than when it comes to what we believe about God. If God exists, and if this is His book, and He said some things to us in it, if that is true, it is the most important thing in every person's life, yours and mine. In fact, the truth is, what I choose to believe about God and the things He said in His book will become, hear me on this, the defining issue of your life and mine, the defining issue of our existence. And so can I ask you this morning, what do you believe? Maybe you're sitting here and you're saying, I'm not sure. I'm trying to figure that out. Welcome to the Kleinwood Church. You are in the right place, surrounded by people who are trying to figure out what is true. Love to join you in your effort to figure that out. But maybe you already know. and you've resisted that and you kicked against it because you were determined to follow culture, or you just got some ideas in your head that you want to be true, but somewhere back there in your mind, you know. He's there, he's spoken, and your path is not his. And maybe you have struggled with that. Before we go this morning, we just want to extend his invitation to you to do something about this. This church family wants to help you find your way back home. And so if you need to make that choice today, whether you're coming to the Lord for the first time, acting on what you know to be true, or coming back to what you know to be true, whatever that is, we want to help you with that. We just need you to do one thing. We need you to have the courage to come on down here to the front, take a seat on this pew, and tell us what your need is. If you want to do that, do it right now, while we stand.